equation here, which was of this type. Prime denotes trace. So phi is here a symmetric tensor of rank S, and that's the differential equation that satisfies according to this Fronsdahl formulation. Let me add, just to remind you what we had yesterday, that this differential equation is invariant under this gauge transformation, conventional gradient of a parameter, provided the parameter is traceless, and then there is this additional condition that the gauge field be doubly traceless in order that the Lagrangian be gauge invariant. Now, the work I described yesterday is based on this first paper with Dario Francia, if people are interested to look at. And it's the second, what I'm going to talk about is today something that is in this second paper with Dario Francia and is worked and extended, worked out and extended in more detail in this recent paper with Sulaia. This is the person I mentioned, a colleague in Padua. He's a postdoc in Padua, Miriam Sulaia, and he's also a student of the late Tolia Pashnev, and as you will see, they've done very interesting work on this BRST type formulation that will emerge. Then in the last part of the talk, if time is left, you know, depending how much time is left, I will discuss some work that I've been doing over the past year with Ergin Sezgin and Per Sundell that has not appeared yet, but at some point when we get all together and we agree on some little details that will appear. Okay, so here is the plan I told you last time. So the first part is what we did, the second, so you can ignore it. The second part, I will tell you about these systems, which are very interesting, and we call them triplets. They are essentially a universal structure that appears, that emerges from string field theory in the tensionless limit. And you will see that many people, including some people in the audience, have stumbled upon these systems over the years. And from the triplets, I will show you that there are two ways to gain information about higher spin field equations. One is by truncation, and the other one is by gauging. I will show you the truncation procedure and also a simple example of the gauging procedure. And by these triplets, they'll guide us to another form, a local form of this higher spin field equations that I gave you in minimal geometric form in the last lecture. The last part will give some rudiments of the Vasiliev equations and describe for you how this extended gauge symmetry plays a role in them, which was a surprise somehow to some extent because the equations were there for a while and the symmetry came up naturally. Now, these are the equations that I showed you last time. Point of the discussion is that if you drop the requirement of locality and you add some compensator terms which can be expressed as non-local combinations of the original gauge fields derivatives and, you know, folded by suitable powers of 1 over box, then you realize that the field equations for odd spins take the form of a generalized Maxwell equation with the power of 1 over box in front, which does precisely what you would like. Namely, the power of 1 over box makes the equation start like box of something plus no local terms, and the no local terms can be gauged away using the trace of the gauge parameter. Notice that it, and the same type of pattern repeats itself for the even spins, where the linearized, here, of course, everything is linearized in this kind of situation, and you will see also why, because higher spins want to be all together if you turn on interactions. So here we study one at a time because we're looking at the linearized equations. For even spins, you get a generalization of the linearized Einstein equation in the form of a trace of a generalized curvature divided by a power of box, which again makes the equation start like box of something plus no local terms which are gauged away. Now, there is a little subtlety, and I don't have time to show it to you. It's discussed in the second paper with Dario Francia, namely, what is simple to understand is that if you start from this generalized equation and use the trace of the gauge parameter to go back, then you end up with an equation in which the no-local terms disappear. However, the field that I'm using here doesn't satisfy the double trace constraint. Now, you will see that when I go to the local compensator form, one of the compensator equations is the double trace constraint. From this point of view, you don't have the double trace constraint, and the subtlety is related to the gauge fixing. The Donder gauges, the generalized Donder gauges, are not good gauges for these theories. If you use modified the Donder gauges which are compatible with the lack of double tracelessness, then the field equation sets to zero the double trace on shell. So in other words, the trace of the gauge parameter allows you to go back to the local form. The double trace is set on, to zero by the properly gauge fixed field equation in this way. Now, here's the fermions. What will be the lesson for the fermions? Just to state the point, we will not find directly a new type of geometry because we know it already from the Rarita-Schwinger equation that the geometry of the bosonic case describes also the fermionic case from this point of view. Now, this stuff is like a Maxwell curl, and the same pattern keeps on going like that for all spins. So you start from the spin 3/2 and you go on to higher spins, and the lesson will be that this bosonic geometric entities will enter the fermionic equations in such a way as is the case here. Now, to display it more directly, it is convenient to play the following trick. And this is the identity that already is there for the Fronsdahl operators. You take the S, remember S is the fermionic operator. S is another way of presenting these equations for all spins. So S is up to a factor of I, d slash of psi minus d of psi slash, where this d is totally symmetrized, and psi is a spin or tensor which carries S, set of S totally symmetric indices. All I'm telling you can be generalized in a less indirect way to mix symmetry, and I mentioned last time that this was done to the extent that it can be done explicitly by de Medeiros and Hall and Becker and Boulanger. But now, in this case, we can really be explicit. Now, the observation I wanted to make is that you can do and play the following little trick. Take the S operator and combine it with minus a half d over box d slash S slash. And see, what you get on the right-hand side is I d slash over box times the bosonic operator of half a spin before. So for spin 1/2 and 0, this is a triviality. It's just telling you that if you take the d slash operator, the d slash operator, you can write it as d slash over box times box, which is the Laplace operator, I mean, the D'Alembert operator for the scalar. But it works for all spins with this addition of the subtraction terms. And for instance, if you do it for spin 3/2 and you take the Rarita-Schwinger equation and you write it in this form, then what you see that for spin 3/2, S mu minus this combination is the Maxwell operator acting on this spin. Now, why is this interesting? It's interesting because we know how to generalize the Maxwell operator to this non-local geometric objects. And if we iterate, I will show you that the left-hand side also changes in a consistent fashion. You get that the iterated fermionic operator is related to the geometric bosonic operator. So if you want, this is the realization of the fact that for the Rarita-Schwinger equation, the equation itself is proportional to the Maxwell curvature, if you want. So for high spins, the same thing will happen. How do you see that? Well, you have to go through a procedure like before. The first step is somehow imposed, and the rest is nicely granted. So you write this iteration equation. You built a sequence of pseudo-differential operators, now fermionic, combining the nth iteration with its trace, in fact, the double gradient of its trace, and with the gradients of its divergence. The reason why this is done is because these fermionic operators are not gauge invariant. We saw it already from the spin 5/2 case last time. They're not gauge invariant, but they vary into the gamma trace of the parameter. Now, what happens if you do this iteration, you get gamma traces of successive traces. So again, you don't have enough indices to play this game, and at some point you are fully satisfied because it's gauge invariant. However, at zero price, you get the Bianchi identities, which allow to conclude that the Lagrangian is also fine. This is the Bianchi identities. See, the Bianchi identities are modified in a way that is n-dependent. For n equal 1, you have the Bianchi identity that you would have for the Frank-Fronsdahl case. So you get basically the divergence of S minus 1 over 2n, the gradient of its trace, minus 1 over 2n, this slash of S slash, is proportional not to the triple gamma trace or to the trace of the gamma trace, but to the nth trace of the gamma trace. So at some point, you don't have enough indices to compute this term. This is 0. The Bianchi identity is conventional without this anomalous term, and the Lagrangian is manifestly gauge invariant. So at the same time, you achieve gauge invariance of the Lagrangian and gauge invariance of the equation. Now, the point I wanted to stress is what I anticipated in the last transparency, namely that for any n, there is a generalization of this relation between S and F. The generalization is very similar to the equation I wrote down for you for spin 3/2. The only thing that changes is this n coefficient, and basically this non-local geometric equation or kinetic term, if you want, for the fermions is related, is proportional to this slashover box times this Fn for the bosons. But this Fn are related to divergences of, or traces of curvatures, as I showed you. So it means that up to this redefinition, the fermionic kinetic terms or the fermionic operators are proportional to this slashover box times these bosonic curvatures. So in other words, just as it happens for the Rarita-Schwinger case, you don't learn anything new going to the fermions, but the fermionic equations are completely determined by the bosonic geometry. So this is the first lesson I wanted to state. Is this clear? Now, I would like to move to the second topic. And the second topic has to do with how and why these structures are hidden behind string theory. And so let me remind you some standard facts. The standard fact for string theory is, of course, well, I'm referring, in fact, explicitly to the bosonic string by the same kind of properties and the fermionic generalization with some proviso related to the GSO projections, which I will make later, apply also to the superstring. So let's look at the bosonic string for simplicity. I will remind you the standard form of the Virasoro operators and the Virasoro algebra. The reason why I'm doing this is that I know I'm not interested in these equations as such, but I'm interested in their tensionless limit. The tensionless limit is very interesting because it lets all the massive states collapse. And if you look at one particular level, you recover a theory of massless high-spin gauge fields for free. So if you rescale the Virasoro operators properly and you let alpha prime go into infinity now, which is the tensionless limit, what happens is that the operators collapse, suitably rescaled, and the L0 operator becomes just a Machel operator, and the LK operators become related to P dot alpha K. Now, if you look at it at face value, you already should anticipate where we're getting. P squared, so the L0 condition will give you a Machel condition. The LK condition, take K equal 1, would give you a divergence type condition. So we're doing something which is similar to what I anticipated from the Fields-Pauli conditions the last lecture. However, we are missing the trace condition. Remember that Fields-Pauli conditions were essentially a box condition, a divergence condition, and a trace condition. String theory gives you a box condition, a divergence condition, no trace condition. The physical reason for that will be the daughter Regge trajectories that are not cut out. And the relation with higher spin gauge theories will need somehow to find a way to eliminate these daughter trajectories, and I will show you these two ways. Now, the first fact that appears strikingly in the alpha prime going to infinity limit is that the central charge drops out the algebra. In other words, the algebra takes the same form independently of the notion of critical dimension is lost. And there is a reason for that. If you look carefully at the string spectrum contains this infinity of massive modes which take mass by some sort of Kaluza-Klein mechanism. But if you follow the details, as I said last time, you don't quite have enough Stueckelberg modes to do it. String theory is careful enough to do it with fewer Stueckelberg modes than you would need. And this doing it with fewer Stueckelberg modes than needed then works only in the critical dimension. When what I'm trying to tell you is related to what I told you yesterday concerning the fact that masses can be added going to an extra dimension. It was automatic. You would just do the Kaluza-Klein reduction, pick a mode, and the masses would come up. In string theory, it doesn't quite look like that. It's instructive to expand the first few massive modes, and you will see that some of the Stueckelberg modes are missing, and the equations are precisely consistent for that reason only in the critical dimension. However, when the alpha prime goes to infinity and the masses collapse, then there is no reason for for this restriction. And in fact, the critical dimension disappears, and these Stuckelberg modes just live their own life. Somehow, a Stuckelberg mode is recovered as an ordinary mode. It's not eaten anymore. It sits there. And now you have this well-known equation that was written now about 20 years ago. And it really started from the work of Kato and Ogawa that analyzed the BRST formulation of the string spectrum. And then it was proposed as an equation for string field theory. It's based on the condition, on the construction of the BRST operator and on the crucial constraint that Q squared to zero, and hence, in the massive string case, that the critical dimension, the dimension be the critical one. However, and of course it has this chain, infinite chain of gauge invariances, by which delta psi is Q of lambda, and delta lambda is Q of lambda prime, delta lambda prime is Q of double lambda double prime, and so on and so forth. Meaning that it's typical of theories of forms, so that you have gauge symmetries of gauge symmetries. However, if you look at these equations at face value, there's no trace constraints on phi or lambda sitting anywhere. So it means that somehow this theory, in the limit of phi prime going to infinity, better be related to the equation I showed you rather than to the Fransdahl equations. Well, you know, what happens is that you don't jump, they don't jump, but they are distributed in a different fashion. The, somehow the Stuckelberg modes are uneaten, so to speak. They make their own life. However, you have to be a bit careful because usually in string theory you have a discrete spectrum of massive modes. Now, when I go to this alpha prime going to infinity, the spectrum collapses, becomes a continuum. So, if you want, everything is a bit messy, but if I look at one of these modes before the limit, and I take the limit, this mode will collapse. I don't have a continuum. I have a single mode. And I can learn from this single mode the meaning of the high spin equations. Of course, you get a continuum of states, but you're free to take one of them. And you will see that a universal structure will appear, which is very simple and rather elegant. And now here is the just a reminder of how it works. When you build the BRST operator to build the string field equations, it is very important to separate the ghost and anti-ghost zero modes out because they play a different role. So, for instance, you see you get, this is the BRST operator, and what I'm doing now here is the limit for alpha prime going to zero, sorry, to infinity, not rather than to zero, and rescaling the generators, and you see that this produces a simplification of Q that can nonetheless be expanded in C0, B0, and ghost zero mode independent part. Exactly the same that happens in the tensile string theory. However, now, of course, the expressions are simplified. The reason why I'm calling your attention to this point is that the standard decomposition. And again, we can proceed as in the tensile string, and decompose the string field and the gauge parameter also in terms of the ghost zero modes. So far it's similar to what you do in the tensile case, but the expressions for the BRST charge and the operators are simpler, and I will now focus on one particular level to avoid, I mean, this collapse, you know, that we have there. So what's this particular, please?
Sorry,
my
question is that, are you thinking
sorry, where are you at? Oh, okay, sure. No. I'm just using string field theory for the time being to learn from another point of view something about free high spin dynamics. I'm not, it's just flat space in the end what I'm trying to get out, right?
Yeah, but suppose I use the same procedure starting with on some consistent non-flat background.
Yeah. No, not interacting. I'm just looking at the free theory. That's why I'm emphasizing that. People have looked at the interactions in the alpha prime going to infinity limit, and modular ambiguity is what you get, that the interactions disappear in the flat background. The idea, however, would be, and there are indications also from the Vasiliev equation that I'll show later, that the interactions don't disappear within the presence of a cosmological constant. And in fact, there is even a conjecture of Sezgin and Sundell that Bianchi, Santleben, and Beisert, and Morales have explored to some extent The conjecture is that there is a critical value of alpha prime where somehow masslessness for the first regular trajectory would show up in an ADS background. So my point of view is completely different. Here I'm trying to follow these equations, take them at face value, and now I'm already there. I'll show you this very nice little system that is universal in string theory. And the point will be to describe for you what this system means, what states it propagates, and how this is related to the free highest spin field equations. That's the point. Please.
The gauge invariance that you talked about last time for the highest spin equations, do they have an analog when alpha prime is not strictly infinity? Is this just the psi goes to q psi gauge invariance?
Sorry, say it again. I was confused.
So,
I didn't hear you properly. I was thinking of something else.
Sorry.
Say it again.
You talked about a gauge invariance that is present in the highest spin equation.
Yes.
Now, string field theory also has a large gauge invariance.
Absolutely.
Are these going to be the same thing?
Well, I know that in the alpha prime going to infinity limit, you do recover that gauge invariance. Okay. However, as I anticipated, the crucial point is that string theory, in its usual tensile state, if you want, its usual tensile formulation, is not exactly a spontaneously broken, a Kaluza-Klein breaking of this infinite, of this zero tension limit. If it were, you would not have a critical dimension, as I said. So it's not exactly, it's almost a Stueckelberg form of this massless case I'm showing you. It's not quite because I'm missing some Stueckelberg modes to do that. And that's what gives you the critical dimension. But for the rest, yes. Somehow you can think of string field theory to be a broken version of this generalized gauge sim that you have in this case.
And in particular, you could follow the gauge invariance of massive string field theory and take the mass goes to zero limit and you recover.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing exactly. Now I'm taking massive string field theory, going to the alpha prime, going to infinity limit, and now I will show you a universal system, this triplet. Then I will argue, without even proving for you, because it's fairly evident, what kind of modes you propagate. And then I will show you that either by truncating the triplet or by gauging the triplet, you will recover the local form of this highest spin field equations with unconstrained gauge symmetry. So there certainly is a relation. The reason why I'm rather cautious to go the other way around is that string field theory, or string theory, if you want, at face value, doesn't really spontaneously break this symmetry in the most naive way, which would be free of a critical dimension, but it does it with fewer Stueckelberg modes than needed. And that's a very important fact, which may even have some deep underpinnings, because many people have suspected for a long time that when you read the string field theory equations and you look at them, you look at them at face value, then they look like the gauge symmetry in a spontaneously broken phase. So somehow alpha prime is parameterizing the spontaneous breaking. But on the other hand, in string theory, it's just a bare parameter. People have had the suspicion for 20 years. The first person that I can quote for telling me this kind of observation was Zumino when I was a postdoc at Berkeley, which is about 20 years ago now. And, you know, people have suspected for a long time that somehow our formulation is incomplete, that somehow alpha prime sits there. You know, it sits there in the geometric formulation for string theory because it's the tension of the string. But it's somehow, we don't know the whole story. And maybe this is, there's something profound in the back. Please.
If I'm following, or I'm totally lost, in which case it might fall.
I don't know. It may be my fault. You can do that, yes.
But we're going to do that now?
Yes. It's already here. This is what the triplet is.
Because a long time ago, we used to play with this. We used to call it same model.
You used to call it?
We used to call it same model. Just
I see. Like it
dynamic.
Could be that it's correlated, because you see, this story starts with, to the best of my knowledge, it starts with Anders Bengtsson in 1986, even. Because the Swedish school has played quite a bit with these issues of higher spins and tensionless limits. And Anders Bengtsson expanded the first three levels of the bosonic string. You're familiar with that work?
That's what I would have in mind. What is your name there? Well, I cannot see from this distance, so I don't really know. But,
No, but it's not, he's not Anders Bengtsson, because I know him. Is. So I, the two works I'm aware of, but I'm ready to correct my transparencies, and I thank you for pointing it out. The two names I'm aware of is Anders Bengtsson and then Heno and Teitelbaum. And the work of Heno and Teitelbaum I know about because Bonelli called it to my attention. So, sorry. So?
So you are going to build a VRST charge in this small space?
Yes, but I'm not using it directly. I will use it as a clue to go to the highest spin equation for a single highest spin. Okay? So, and then the other people that I know of are Pashnev and Sulaya, but we can, I'm very happy to discuss the rest of what I don't know. And the point is the following, that remember that this Virasoro algebra in this truncated limit looked like Ln commutated with L minus N goes to L0. So the point is that you can essentially build states modulo this collapse, because, you know, you get these continuum states that collapse. You can look at one particular set of states which are built out of the only oscillator alpha minus 1. So, for instance, a state like this would be not necessarily a totally symmetric object because it's built out of only alpha minus 1, which is just this psi variable that I had last time. However, in string field theory, you don't have only the state, you don't have only the states, because you also have the possibility, and in fact the need, to introduce corresponding ghost and anti-ghost modes. So it means that this field phi is always accompanied in this phi 1. Remember that phi 1 and phi 2 were related by this C0 expansion. The field phi is always accompanied by another field D. And there is this other field, phi 2, which appears in the C0 term, which is typically auxiliary fields, which is a single field, C1, C mu 1 mu s minus 1. So in other words, you have a triplet of fields, phi, which is a symmetric tensor of rank s, C, which is a symmetric tensor of rank s minus 1, and D, which is a symmetric tensor of rank s minus 2. They always go together in a triplet. Now, the BRST equations are very simple, and the first equation tells you that box of phi is the symmetrized gradient of C. The second equation, you can call it somehow the gauge condition if you want, in disguise. The divergence of phi minus the gradient of D defines algebraically the field C. Sorry, and the third equation is telling you that the box of the third field is the divergence of C. And these equations are invariant under this unconstrained gauge transformation. The variation of phi is the gradient of lambda, the variation of C is box of lambda, and the variation of D is D dot lambda. Yes. Sorry, what is the difference between phi 2 and 1? One is the gauge parameter, one is a piece of the gauge field, because the gauge field is always written as one field plus C0 times another field. You have to do the expansion in ghost zero modes. But one is the gauge parameter. It has a different ghost number, right? Delta phi equal Q lambda. So it's shifted by one in ghost number. Okay, so this is the system, and now let's forget about, in fact, no, let me tell you why I know that these people were doing this. As I said, Anders Bengtsson was looking at the structure of field, string field, of high spin fields for the first few levels. The work of Heno and Teitelbaum that I'm aware of, in fact, contains a generalization of this construction to tensors which are built out of different alpha oscillators. In fact, we rebuilt that stuff, and then Bonelli told us that there was this paper of them, and the content is exactly essentially the same. So in other words, if you use not only alpha minus 1, but a bunch of different oscillators, alpha minus 1, alpha minus 2, alpha minus 3, you generalize this construction in a way that contain tensors which are not fully symmetric. It's a bit more complicated than this, because there is, I mean, if you want to really describe it in an off-shell form, you need more than this naive triplet type of fields. So in other words, in that case, you would have naively a field phi, a set of CI fields, and a set of phi of DIJ fields. But that's not enough. You don't get a Lagrangian system with that. If you need, other fields that the BRST formulation gives you, but you can generalize it. But now let's look at this system directly, and let's see if we can understand what's going on here. Now, You see that, suppose you redo the construction in light cone gauge. The construction in light cone gauge will only introduce, will only be using the alpha minus one I transverse oscillators. And so this, the state will be created on the vacuum, sorry, with this kind of operators. Now, if you look at the modes here, you'll certainly get a spin S mode, but the trace will become a spin S minus two mode, the double trace a spin S minus four mode, or so on and so forth. So, of course, you have to rediagonalize them. So it's clear that this system is propagating not only spin S, but spin S, S minus two, S minus four, S minus six, down to zero or one, which is these daughter trajectories. In other words, you are just imposing two of the three Fitzpauli conditions, the box, the Machel condition, and the divergence condition, but you are missing the trace condition. And that's essentially, that's exactly why Pashnev and Sulaya were studying these systems, because they were essentially studying them as the simplest setting for the, this BRST construction, where you are imposing only the minimal set of physical conditions, the box and divergence. Then they also generalized this stuff to the trace part, which will come up later. Now, apart from the fact that it's a very neat system, why are we interested in this? First of all, if you can also eliminate C in this in these equations, and that's how somehow Bengtson had them. You see that now the first equation becomes F, the Fronsdahl operator, equal D squared of phi prime, which is the trace of phi, minus 2D. And the second equation becomes a differential equation for D. And it's very simple to write a Lagrangian for this system in both cases. As I already stressed, this system conceptually is imposing this physical state condition. Box equals zero, divergence equals zero, but it's dropping out of the Fitzpauli conditions the trace. And the consequence of that is the propagation of the lower spin replications, replicas, okay? Actually, you can even extend this triplet putting a cosmological constant. And here I should mention one point, which is really coming closer to the discussion of high spin interaction. There is an old result, which is somehow often stated as the Aragon desert problem. The problem is the following. If you try to generalize the high spin field equations, which are written in flat space to begin with, or Lagrangians for that matter, then the gauge invariance of a Lagrangian results in general from partial integrations of a number of derivatives which are hidden in the Lagrangian. And now, of course, if you go to the curved space, two derivatives in general don't commute. And not only they don't commute, but in general their commutation relation generates naked Riemann tensors. The first case when a disaster of this type should and could occur, in principle, is the Rarita-Schwinger equation. If you write the Rarita-Schwinger action and you vary it, then you generate the commutator of two covariant derivatives in the Rarita-Schwinger action, and this commutator of covariant derivative gives you the Riemann tensor. However, the number of indices are not sufficient, if you want, or the spin 3/2 field couples in a benign way to gravity, and all these Riemann tensors effectively combine into an Einstein tensor. The Einstein tensor is precisely the variation of the Einstein term, and that's how supergravity is consistently working. However, when you go on to higher spins, this miracle doesn't happen anymore. You generate naked Riemann tensors, and you cannot cancel them against the gravitational term. However, if you are in a DS or ADS background, then in this case, the maximal symmetry in this case, if you want, first of all, they are conformally flat backgrounds. The Weyl tensor vanishes. And in this case, the whole Riemann tensor is proportional to the cosmological term. So all these extra terms can be reabsorbed in a DS or ADS background. And they look exactly like mass term additions to the original equations. To be specific, if I take the triplet, there is a way to extend the triplet to an ADS background or DS. I go from one to the other, changing the sign of L squared in this, at this level. You see, the basic idea to extend the triplet is to insist on maintaining the condition that C be a field defined algebraically in terms of phi and D by the same equation that holds in flat space, but of course now with the derivatives covariantized as it should be. As a consequence, once phi and d are given the canonical curve space gauge transformation, C is bound to acquire in its gauge transformation 1/L² corrections of this type. And once you have the full gauge transformations, then it takes a little bit of work, but at the end, you can go and build the modified triplet. So this modified triplet goes through to ADS or DS background, which of course is not the case for string field theory in the tensile case, because you would have problems with the critical dimension, as you all know. But in this tensionless limit, these equations go through to an ADS or DS background. The reason why I'm telling you this is that now I will proceed and try to derive, use the triplet as somehow a source of information to derive or justify for you the local compensator form for the equations I wrote last time. And this local compensator form is nothing very surprising at the end of the day, because we saw it already in disguise. When I wrote for you last time this equation in general, I showed you that one can arrive at a form in which f is 3d cubed h, where h is a composite of phi derivatives and null localities of various types. However, h is bound to vary into the trace of the gauge parameter, because the variation of f is 3d cubed all lambda prime by consistency. So the idea of a local compensator form is precisely to treat h as another independent field. And now you will see that the triplet exactly leads you in that direction. Okay, so this is the other way to write the triplet equations. This is the way without C. You see, it becomes a bit more complicated. But you can still prove a number of interesting properties that will be useful later. For instance, the object that plays the role of the Fronsdahl operator is this modified Fronsdahl operator with a mass-like term, which involves both phi and its trace. And it satisfies a Bianchi identity, which is also deformed. You see that the right-hand side of the Bianchi identity is this anomalous term. In the flat case, we had an anomalous term which contained three derivatives, the triple gradient of the double trace of phi. And here, in the DS or ADS case, we also get a single gradient divided by L squared, again of the double trace of phi. So this anomalous term is modified, as you would expect, by dimensional reasons, but it still stays there. And if you eliminate C, then you see that you get this equation here, which is, tells you that this modified Fronsdahl operator is somehow the double gradient of this expression that involves phi and d plus 1/L² terms. So this is as far as one can go with a triplet without falling into the problem of getting the various spins to interact with one another. And this is the corresponding Lagrangian. However, one can also do this construction directly starting from the BRST procedure and modifying it. Essentially, what happens, remember that the BRST constraints were based on the p-square constraint and the p-dot alpha constraints. Now p becomes a covariant derivative, so the p's don't commute with one another. And then what happens is that the gauge algebra that you get becomes a nonlinear algebra. However, what happens for the triplet, that as far as the triplet is concerned, these operators are the nonlinear terms in this gauge algebra are take a fixed eigenvalue in the triplet. So the algebra effectively behaves like a linear algebra, and you can repeat the BRST construction ignoring the nonlinearity. If you do it, then you get exactly the same result that we got by the direct construction. And now, let me show you why I'm interested in the triplets. You see, the point of the triplets is that we have all this chain of descending spins that propagate. But it is easy to see how the lowest spins set in, because the gauge transformation that we have, according to which delta phi, the gauge variation of phi, is the gradient of lambda, and the other gauge transformation of d, which is the divergence of lambda, imply that the gauge transformation of phi prime minus 2d is the gradient of lambda prime. So in other words, if phi behaves under its gauge transformation as a canonical spin S field, the combination of phi prime minus 2d behaves like a canonical spin S minus 2 field. So suppose you want to describe the spin S fields, what you can do is somehow look for particular waves, particular solutions of these equations, where the spin S minus 2 field is pure gauge. So in other words, if I constrain the triplet imposing the condition that phi prime minus 2d, which is precisely the object that transforms into the gradient of lambda prime, be pure gauge, then the triplet collapses to the first equation, which is f equals 3d cube alpha. And nicely enough, what happens is that the second equation, which looks like a bona fide differential equation for d, collapses to the condition that d squared of phi double prime is equal to d squared of this expression. So modulo constants, the second equation becomes the double trace constraint, which for alpha equals 0 becomes Fronsdahl's condition that phi double prime is 0 and f equals 0. But if alpha is different from 0, it becomes an inhomogeneous Fronsdahl equation together with this modified double trace constraint that relates the compensator alpha, alpha transforms under gauge transformation to a trace of lambda, to the double trace of phi. Let me stress that the Bianchi identity of the first yellow equation above, the Bianchi identity of the first equation implies the double trace constraint. So we have relaxed Fronsdahl conditions this way, adding a single compensator, obtained conceptually letting the lower spin modes described by the triplet, which is the universal sector for symmetric tensors that arises from string theory in the tensionless limit. So we just decouple the lower modes, and look what we got, exactly this inhomogeneous equation together with the double trace constraints, which is relaxed, modified. It's not phi double prime equals 0, but it's phi double prime related to this compensator field. If we fix alpha equals 0 by the trace of the gauge parameter, we go back to that formulation modulo the double trace constraint. Sorry, in this case, even with the double trace constraint, precisely. Now, you can ask yourself, what is the relation between this equation and the non-local equations? And that's very simple, because essentially, if you iterate these conditions, the equation f equal 3 d cube alpha implies by iteration that f2 is 5 over box d to the fifth derivative on alpha prime, and so on and so forth. So if you keep on iterating, alpha is replaced by its traces, and at some point it disappears, and you get the homogeneous equation in terms of the non-local f that I was proposing last time. So somehow the circle closes here. And now the next issue that I want to discuss for you, of course, is how to do it with fermions. But this is somehow the statement, just to emphasize it again. So that this set of equations, which are obtained by this truncation condition, if you want, on the triplet, describe a single spin S gauge field with no trace constraints on the gauge parameter, no trace constraints on the gauge fields. And the field equation can be reduced to the minimal non-local form. But the important point is that these are not Lagrangian equations. So you cannot get them imposing the restriction on the Lagrangian. To impose the restriction on the Lagrangian, you have to make to promote the trace condition to a gauge condition. And this requires the addition of a number of extra auxiliary modes for a total of order S spin modes. I will show you at some point how you do that. Before getting there, let me stress that also this compensator equation can be extended to a DS or an ADS background. Why does one do this exercise? The point is that the Vasiljev equations are formulated in terms with a cosmological constant. Therefore, if one looks at the Vasiljev equations in the free limit, one has to expand them with respect to an ADS background. And in order to ask oneself whether the gauge symmetry realized there is this extended gauge symmetry or the constrained Fronsdahl gauge symmetry, then one has to weigh a way to compare it. And to compare the equations, you have essentially to go to this form. And now you see that what happens, basically, that the F operator is modified by this mass term. If I pull it to the left-hand side, I would define this FL. And then the compensator term also gets a modification of order 1 over L squared. The constraint relating phi double prime and alpha is not changed. And so the gauge conditions are also not changed. They are preserved in the original form. Okay. So this is the next point. How much time do we have? 20 minutes, okay. Now, It is possible to obtain a Lagrangian form for the compensator equations at the expense of adding extra fields. And this is essentially contained in the work of Pashnev and Sulaya that worked for a number of years on this type of systems, considering all the cases of ADS backgrounds, gauging out the traces and the like. And basically what one does, one has to do a clever modification of the BLST procedure, because naively the trace constraint leads to some equations which are inconsistent, and one has to be very careful to impose them, and one has to modify the BLST procedure in a very smart way. I will not discuss you this detail, but I will rather show you explicitly how it works, because it's, the end result is very intuitive. You can do it without even going through the details, how it works for low enough spin. Now, here, I'm essentially doing the spin 3 case. And you see basically what happens. Let's look at the equations in the second set. You see basically what one does, one modifies the triplet by the addition of the red terms. So, for instance, in fact, I should have put some terms in red also above. You see, basically what one wants to do is to be able to gauge away out of the gauge field phi also its trace. So you basically have to add an extra gauge parameter, mu, which has exactly the same index structure as the trace of phi. But in order to enforce this additional gauge symmetry, you must modify the first field equation, the equation for phi, adding this extra field f. And now this extra field f is exactly like c with respect to the new gauge symmetry. You see, the structure originally was that box of phi was going into the gradient of c, and c is essentially the Donder gauge condition, because it varies into box of the gauge parameter. So you add an extra gauge parameter, and you add an extra field that transforms into box of the new gauge parameter. That makes the first field equation consistent. However, this field equation comes from the Lagrangian variation. This field equation would come out multiplied by delta phi, so you would have a delta phi here and here. So the next term here tells you something different, something that you need also to enforce on the other equations. But first of all, the second equation will be not automatically compatible if phi is assigned the new gauge transformation. So you will have also to vary the gauge transformation of mu, sorry, of d by mu that is entering here. And you'll also need to add an extra field that absorbs the divergence of this mu parameter coming from the divergence of phi. So the second equation is modified. So you go on modifying the equations, and now you notice that this equation comes from a Lagrangian variation times the equation itself. Now what happens then? That if you integrate by parts, you get information about the new equations, and you go in iteration until you close. And when you close the story here, so to reiterate, you modify the phi field equation, phi gauge transformation, I'm sorry, adding a gauge transformation that gauges away the trace, and then you get all these other transformations one by one by consistency, and the equations one by one by consistency until you can go. Then you integrate by parts, so to speak, and get information about the equations of the missing field, of the new fields, and this system closes at this point, not with three, but with eight field equations. Now, what happens is that, of course, you can gauge field these field equations, and if you gauge field this field equation using mu, the mu parameter to gauge away this field phi 1, and the lambda 1 parameter to remove C1, then you end up with the triplet with the compensator, of course. The triplet plus the compensator like we had before. So this is an off-shell system that partly gauge fixed goes back to the triplet plus the compensator. And this can be done for all spins.
What happens if you look at the kinetic
term with the you mean whether you see this other stuff there? Uh-huh. Well, these Lagrangians, in fact, for these guys are obtained exactly in the same form. So, for instance, you have this contracted BLST operator, and you have this set of fields, but you have to define what BLST operator you have. In other words, what algebra you have. Before, I had an algebra which was really imposing only the constraint on the divergence. Now I'm enlarging the gauge algebra, gauging away the trace. I can construct the BLST operator, and all these Lagrangians are effectively built precisely in this form, with a suitable BLST operator that applies to the case, precisely like that. In fact, I was not even getting from the Lagrangian because, you know, at the end of the day, the construction for the BLST operator is rather subtle, but you can essentially go through the equation. That is a very simple logic. You modify the gauge transformation of phi, you stick it into the equation, you have something that absorbs the gauge transformation, you go through, and then you integrate by parts and you get the others. And the question is whether it closes or not. And in this way, it closes. All the equations are consistent. So that's how you can justify it. Otherwise, you have to do a subtle rotation of the constraints because you have a constraint which looks like second class and you have somehow to rotate it into first class. But I'm not going to that detail. It's very interesting. It's in the work of Pashnev and Tsvayev. And by the way, Pashnev is deeply missed because he died tragically a few months ago. And so I'm very happy to tell you about their work because I think they deserve more attention than they got in the past. Now, there is a generalization of the bosonic triplet that is relatively simple to guess, and we guessed it with Dario Francia in the second paper. It's almost the same story, but not quite. The first equation tells you that d slash of psi is equal to d of another field, which is the analog of c in this case. The second equation is d dot psi minus gradient of lambda is d slash on this other field. And the third equation is d slash of lambda equal to the divergence of chi. So the only difference is that this slash is sort of evenly distributed among the first equation and the second one. Before we had a box in the first equation and nothing in the second one. So what reads like d slash of chi would be c in that case. And now the d slash is sort of evenly distributed up and down. What's the result? That this system propagates spin s plus 1/2, s minus 1/2, and down. Before we were going in jumps of two spins. And here we go in steps of one. And the question, does it enter string theory? Yes, it does, but not so directly, because here I'm discussing for you totally symmetric tensor spinors. And the GSO projection throws them away in the superstrings. They are perfectly there in the type zero strings, or simple generalization of these ones where the indexes are not totally symmetric apply directly also to the superstring. So the lesson is again that in the alpha prime going to infinity limit you get this sort of universal relatively simple structures. Although there are some technical problems to extend this fermionic triplet to ADS. So the fermionic triplet doesn't extend to ADS directly. However, the compensator equations do extend. And that's what I would like to show you now. First of all, that the Fang-Fronsdahl operator that you have there for arbitrary half-integer spin is this one. And here I apologize, there is an error here. This should read like divergence of S minus this terms. There's always something missing in the Bianchi identity. Now, the compensator equation is the following. S is not zero anymore, but it's some source term that depends on this compensator. And here, and notice that this is a spin S minus 2 compensator, not a spin S minus 3 compensator like in the bosonic case. And the second equation is just, if you want, the natural counterpart of what we showed before, namely that the trace of the gamma trace, or rather the triple gamma trace of psi, is a linear combination of terms involving divergence, gradient, and this slash of the compensator. These equations are consistent because you can show that the Bianchi identity for the first one implies the second one. And they are a gauge invariant under this unconstrained gauge transformation here with delta psi equal d epsilon and delta xi equal epsilon slash. If you put xi equal zero, you recover this Fronsdahl formulation. And again, although somehow they are very natural to guess at this point, they are again implied by the tensionless limit of this fermionic triplet. Also, in this case, you can extend the construction to ADS. And here it becomes a bit tedious because what happens is that the gauge transformation of the psi field itself is modified. This is familiar. You should know an analog of that. And the analog of that is the gravitino that takes a term which is of order 1 over L times gamma epsilon, precisely that type of form. If you work with gauge supergravity, the gravitino gets this modification. But to carry through this modification, this compensates the equations and the Bianchi identity. But the end lesson is the same, that this equation here with these ADS-type terms and this trace condition go through and they are consistently related. The Bianchi identity on the first one implies the second one. These details you can find in this paper with Tsulaya if you're interested. Now, here, I would like to make, in the few minutes that I'm left with, some comments which do not give justice to the Vasiliev equation, but give you a little bit an idea of what's going on there. And the conclusion that I would like to transmit you is that there is a subtlety here, but modulo this subtlety, this gauge symmetry is realized in this equation, not the Fronstad one, this one. Now, what is the conceptual basis of the Vasiliev equation? Of course, there is a lot of technicalities, but basically what one does in that case, one builds an algebra which generalizes the OD minus, OD comma 2 transverse ADS or D minus 1 comma 1 in the DS case, the tangent space algebra. So you have this tangent space algebra which generalizes the Lorentz algebra. In fact, with the cosmological term, you include an extra dimension. And the generators of this algebra, let me call them TAB, you can split them in the longitudinal parts, call it TA and the TA and the transverse one. So this A will be a small a and an extra index. And these generators play the role of ADS translations. This play the role of ADS angular momenta, and they satisfy this tangent space algebra. Now, this tangent space algebra, you want to extend it, and to extend it, basically, you build these operators as bilinears in oscillators, and you introduce a star product algebra for these oscillators, or if you want, for their symbols, or if you want, you work with vial-order product of these oscillators, and you don't only build bilinears to build these generators, but you build arbitrary powers of this object, and these arbitrary powers generate, naturally, if you gauge the algebra, tensors of arbitrary rank. Now, the question is which oscillators you should use. If you are in four dimensions, and Vasiliev for many years used the spinor oscillators. The spinor oscillators are objects that satisfy an algebra of this type. Let me write it like this. Y alpha star y beta is y alpha y beta, which is the Weyl-ordered product, like classical numbers, plus a certain coefficient times epsilon alpha beta. This applies to four dimensions. It gives you a description of these tensors where the tangent space indices are in two-component notation. However, it applies specifically to four dimensions. If you want to go beyond four dimensions, then you have to do it either case by case, and this was done at the linearized level by Sesgin and Sundell in D equal 5 and 7, where spinor formulations are similar to these ones, modulo a subtlety, which I will come back to, are also available. Or you can do the following thing. You just introduce bosonic oscillators, YIA, and you let them satisfy the following algebra. And here's the subtlety. The subtlety is the index I. So this algebra is the following, YIA, YJB, plus epsilon IJ, eta AB. So in other words, you see what happens is that effectively you want to realize a commutator algebra. For these objects. Now, the commutator algebra, of course, needs antisymmetric structure constants, but the natural metric for these variables A and B, which are now valued in the vector representation of the tangent space group, the natural metric is symmetric, it's the eta. And therefore, you have to fold it with an antisymmetric metric, and you really have to essentially realize not your OD2, but you have to realize an OD2 times an SP2R. So you really have a redundancy of oscillators. Then all your fields are built out of infinite polynomials, power series effectively, with these oscillators. But you have an infinite redundancy also coming from this internal SP2R, and you have to cut it out. And cutting out this infinity is non-trivial. That's why these equations that Vasiliev proposed in 2003 are still somewhat implicit from this point of view. So here is the algebra, here is the star product algebra, and then to organize this mess of power series in these oscillators, you introduce two operations. One is the tau operation, and one is the pi operation. The tau operation is just a way to distinguish the power series terms, and you basically typically impose that the gauge fields are eigenstates of the tau operation. In practice, you can in fact generalize the theory, imposing that the tau of the gauge field be an eigenstate of the tau operation modulo transposition. So in other words, this theory, in the back of its structure, admits a generalization of Champaton factors, which should tell you that, deeply speaking, this theory is related to open strings in the tensionless limit, which is what, yes? I agree. In fact, I'm not pushing that point of view forward. Absolutely, I'm not pushing that point of view forward. My point is that this is a dynamical system which is very interesting and should be analyzed before. So I'm not really one of the people that are prone to. Now, the point I wanted to make is that, yeah, I just want to call your attention to this point. That this is a subtlety. Because these equations, although I'm not showing it to you in this little one, this couple of transparencies I have here, three or four transparencies, I'm not showing you this detail, but this equation can be generalized endowing this high spin master fields by a Champaton index. And they are still consistent in the same way that they are consistent when this object is a singlet. When this object is a singlet, one talks about minimal high spin gauge theories. And the minimal high spin gauge theories are the analog of a case which is discussed long ago in the review that John Schwartz wrote on string theory in the early 80s. John Schwartz considered formally the case in which the Champaton group would be O1. You know that in the O group, you basically get alternating symmetric and antisymmetric representation at all levels. So in practice, formally, if you are in the O1 case, these states are not existing. This thing is singlet. This thing is not existing. Single singlet, and so on and so forth. So you really get a spectrum with alternating even spins, and the odd spins are thrown out. In some sense, this theory is built like this. Conceptually, what is this theory? This theory is based on, first of all, the obvious thing that you do also in gravity, which is introducing gauge fields which are valued in the algebra that you have. In gravity, you have this algebra with this generator, which I can call PA and TAB, and then you introduce gauge fields, which are one forms, if you want, which are valued in this Lie algebra, and you recognize that this is the field bind and this is the spin connection. Or if you want, all together, you have essentially an object like this in D plus one dimensions. Now, the generalization here is rather natural. Instead of considering objects which are valued in this algebra, I have an algebra which is built out of arbitrary products of these objects, this YIA. So I consider arbitrary products of these guys, and basically I would generate gauge fields which are valued in the adjoint of this algebra, which is obtained extending to arbitrary non-polynomial, arbitrary high-degree polynomials, the quadratic product of the y's that generate this OD2 algebra. However, in this case, if I wanted to build these OD2 generators, then this would result if I consider these expressions. So in other words, I have to saturate the SP2 indices. And the same thing I have to do for all the high spin counterparts. So I consider essentially all these arbitrary polynomials, and I essentially look at SP2 singlets in this construction. That's the gauge field. So Vasiliev has an analog of these fields, which is a master one form, A. And then there is the smart trick that somehow he developed over the years, which is what is called the unfolded formulation. Let me just discuss it in very simple terms. Suppose you want to write the Einstein equation. Well, you can do it in this form, but somehow you have to contract indices with the field bind because you would like to write something like R mu nu equals zero, where really, strictly speaking, this is a generalized R mu nu built out of this algebra, which contains the cosmological term. So that equation is R mu nu equal lambda G mu nu in disguise. However, to do that, you really have to contract indices with the field bind, which is a bad thing to do because you cannot do it in order to preserve high spin gauge symmetry. So what he does is something of this form. Instead of writing Ricci equals zero, he writes an equation which is of the form Riemann equal Weyl. So the indices are not contracted, and the equation is consistent. But if the Weyl tensor is traceless, which is an algebraic condition of the internal direction, then this equation implies this other one, but without the need of contracting with the field bind. So it's manifestly compatible with gauge symmetry. However, this equation has to be consistent. So if you take the exterior derivative of this one, Also, the while tensor will generate other terms, and so on and so forth, and the equations have to go through. In order to do this, you have to introduce an infinity of fields. So, you basically have a single infinity of fields, which build up the gauge field, and a double infinity of fields, which build up this, which build up this zero form, phi, which is called, it's said to transform in the twisted adjoint representation, which is an elegant way to say that this equation mixed all these infinity of fields. So there are double mixing. They have infinity of fields that correspond to the various mass levels, so to speak, have collapsed. And then for each of these fields, there is another infinity of fields. So phi is doubly infinite, so to speak. And the equations look remarkably simple. They look, in fact, like linear equations. However, they look so if you extend your space-time by adding a pair of coordinates, the z-coordinates, which satisfy non-commutative algebra, and you extend the gauge field in the internal directions. Basically, the non-linearity of this equation is induced by the non-commutativity in the extra directions, and the interactions are defined by iteration, essentially, of the internal equations. The internal equation can be solved by iteration. Let me show them to you here, then I will go back with one last comment and I'm finished. And essentially integrating the internal components, these equations look like field equations where the source always only lies in the extra dimensions. You can basically integrate out the extra equations and get effective space-time equations, removing the internal non-commutative direction, but you get an infinite non-linearity. The question is, what can you get out of this kind of equations? Well, for the equations which are built out of Spinoria oscillators, there is no subtlety because you don't have to vary to factor out the SP2. And if you do that, then you get, you derive the standard Fronsdahl high spin gauge symmetry and high spin field equations, because working with Spinoria oscillators in internal space, you have total symmetry in spinors, which takes away the traces automatically. And the same thing you can repeat in 7 and 5 dimensions, but there already you have some trace condition to impose. If you do it with this formulation, which is valid for any dimension, let me stress that this describes, at the end of the day, fully symmetric tensors. Then what happens is that the crucial issue here is how to treat the SP2. And how do you treat the SP2? Basically, what happens is that off-shell, you have two ways to describe this equation. People use the term off-shell, but it's very confusing because you don't really have a Lagrangian formulation. These are non-Lagrangian equations. But what they mean by off-shell in this context is that you write some equations which are mere definitions of curvatures. For instance, if I write an equation like this, and I don't constrain the Weyl tensor to be traceless, the would-be Weyl tensor to be traceless, this has no dynamics. The dynamics comes once this thing is traceless. If I take the trace, I get Ricci equals 0. Otherwise, it's just a mere recursive definition of curvatures. You can do it, and you can ask yourself, under what condition are these equations consistent? Well, basically, you have to project out, you have somehow to impose that this phi field, these Weyl curvatures, commute with these SP2 generators. This pi is a complication that I have no time to go through. But in the on-shell case, and that's what we would like to propose with Sezgin and Sundell, but we are still debating on the issue, is that the condition will be enforced in the strong sense. If you enforce it in the strong sense, then the free equation gives you precisely the high spin field equations for all spins consistently. Otherwise, you violate, you don't get the correct ADS mass terms. Once you do that, then what happens? What happens is that the issue is how do you project these equations? The idea here is to project the Weyl tensors, which are somehow the sources on these equations, and to let the gauge fields adjust to them, which is sort of natural. You restrict the sources, you let the gauge fields adjust. If you do that, then the high spin extended symmetry that I showed you is manifestly realized. One last word. When you impose these conditions, Kij, the strong projection conditions, you really push the star product algebra to the end of its definitions, if you want, and beyond. Because these conditions lead to differential equations which can be solved and integrated. For instance, Kij is expressible in terms of a Bessel function of the oscillators. You know, a Bessel function of the oscillator means it's an infinite power series. And to go from Weyl order to star product basis, in that case, produces divergences. And the star product, in order to enforce this strong condition, needs to be regulated. Apparently, it can be regulated. The equations are consistent. And this is somehow the state of the game. Thank you.
Yeah. We have time for one or less questions, and maybe we can delay discussion for the coffee. Is there any question?
Sorry if I went a bit too long.
In standard theory, you only have low spin fields, and one is very happy to see that massless states in string theory have only small spin. And so, can one interpret what you are doing that you are looking for hidden gauge symmetries in string theory and string field theory?
Yeah, from one motivation is that one. Another motivation is just to explore what field theory can do beyond the usual limits. There is one point that I didn't stress. Maybe I can take this opportunity to point it out to you, that when you construct this phi field, remember that there were these two fields, A and phi. A is essentially the gauge fields, and this is the Weyl curvatures. It's not exactly the Weyl curvatures, and somehow it contains high spin Weyl curvatures, but it also contains a scalar field. So this theory contains also some limited number of low spin gauge fields, which are essentially determined by the properties of some representation which are called singletons. If you take products of two singletons, for people who know what that is, then you basically can generate the structure of these terms. It's group theoretically determined. Now, once you determine this object, it always contains a limited number of low spin gauge fields. So there is a field that in some sense you would like to interpret as, let me use a big name, an analog of the dilaton somehow in this kind of theories. But let me stress that the theories that one is able to deal with now are only with symmetric tensors. Supersymmetric interacting equations have been written only in four dimensions. No Lagrangian is known, which is exactly the same kind of difficulty. That's why I went through the triplet, the truncation, and the extended fields. Because to go off-shell, you need a much wider number of fields, and somehow we don't dispose of that. And they're all based on these Cartan integrable systems. But I would like to stress that the Witten's three-cubic string field theory is also based on a Cartan integrable system. Because it's also an equation which, if you look at it, if you look at it in superficial terms, it is an equation which tells you that f equals zero. So it looks like a topological equation, but with an infinite number of degrees of freedom, which then propagates. And so are these Vasilev equations. They are very similar in some sense. Sure. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course you can do it. You can expand in power series of these interactions. And what do we know? You can ask yourself, what do we know explicitly? For instance, one thing that was derived, and it's interesting, is that there is a peculiar scalar cubic coupling that can be argued to be vanishing on other grounds and can be constructed directly by expanding these equations. And this one has been verified. Then the field equation at the free level have been verified for all spins. And the equation, the interaction become messier and messier. But conceptually, if you keep in mind what I was telling you about the free field equations in ADS or flat space, it is an issue of gauging extra symmetries, of introducing many more fields that are present in the Vasilev formulation. And the off-shell formulation can be found and is sitting somewhere. The point is that this idea of Cartan integrable systems is so powerful that allows you to get consistent equations to all orders in the interactions in one shot. Explicitly, at the off-shell level, people went up to the cubic level. At the Lagrangian level, people can write cubic interactions which are consistent up to that point. And they know it in a variety of cases, starting from the mid-80s even. They started in Lightcon gauge, Brink and collaborators, and up to now, Vasilev even recently, wrote down cubic interactions. To go to all orders, this trick of the Cartan integral system is so powerful that it gives you in one shot the whole story. But of course, the equations are rescrambled in a way that they're not very easy somehow to compare with the rest. But I certainly agree with you that it's behind the corner, it's doable in principle, but one needs somehow a smart way to extend to all orders what one can do order by order.
Well, can you have a classical field theory, classical field
Yes, of course you can do it. Why not? Why can't you do that? Even if you write the Fronsdal equation in the simplest case, there's no difficulty to write this thing here. This requires sources which are traceless, but nonetheless, what's So you are asking, well, what can be the analog of that? It's just a product of charges divided by the same power of r squared for static objects.
You're asking
who are these charges? Okay, so in different terms, you are asking who are the currents that couple to the high spin gauge fields. Very good, I can answer that. Now, if you take a free Lagrangian, in the free limit, the standard Lagrangian admit an infinity of high spin currents. You can build them. They are essentially order two polynomials in the fields. If you want to do it Fronsdal's way, they are they're subject to trace conditions. If you don't want to do that, you drop the trace conditions. And this analog of the static case, you can build it out of two currents of this type, which are conserved in the limit, the free limit, times a propagator given by this field. Up to that point, it was known for a while, already from Fronsdal's days. The point is to build consistently these currents out of non-polynomial structures in the fields and to go to fully consistent interacting of shell formulations. No, go ahead. That's Oh, we can discuss privately if you want.
Just one more.
Okay.
For spin 2, the cavern is very tricky because you see the two inches cavern, also called a standard momentum center, and then you have to contract it with a hidden vector to get a proper cavern.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would think that for higher spin, it would not be just a normal cavern. So I am surprised when you say it's just a matter of straightforward calculation to compute the cavern.
But what do you have in mind? Two currents interacting in flat space by a single propagator exchange? That's what I'm answering. In the simplest case, that's what I'm answering, essentially. Two currents interacting in flat space by single propagator exchange.
But how many indices does the cavern have for
high spin?
Which is the source of the spin,
Three indices. Yes. It says the right-hand side of the Fronsdal equation for that field.
And you make a normal cavern by subtracting two sets of indices with hidden vectors.
I repeat, what I'm answering here is the question relative to flat space.
Yes.
So if you want to get two gravitons to interact, what you do, you take T mu nu, you multiply, so this is the scope of my answer. You take T mu nu, you multiply by pi mu nu rho sigma, and you multiply by T rho sigma. Claim is that this kind of operation goes through to all spins. What you are asking is a different question, which is very interesting, but is beyond my answer. Is the following, if I can understand and state it in different terms. If you take the energy momentum tensor and you fold it into a Killing vector, then you generate a conserved current. Then you can show that this object is conserved. Okay? But that's beyond what I'm answering, because this has to do with the symmetries of a curved background, and you are asking somehow how to generalize this construction. Maybe, I haven't thought about it, but in principle, it should be the same story, because if I, instead of having this one, I have an object which is T mu nu rho, and I contract it with xi nu xi rho, then if I can assume a covariance constancy condition for this one, this implies the conservation of this guy. But again, it doesn't tell me much, you know, because the real problem of the interacting equation is to generate the nonlinear current in terms of the fields consistently, and that's another story. Okay? Okay.
We will meet back at 12.